Hello, and so this is going to be probably a relatively short episode of Let the Bible Speak. Just a topic that came across during our weekly Bible reading, and just there was a thought that really struck me as I was reading this, and I'm hoping to share that. I'll ask a question at the end of the class and kind of see what people think. As always, please feel free to comment. I can monitor your comments here. I'm just doing a solo at the moment, so hopefully, I just learned something. Hopefully, others will join. I have to repeat my invitation to my granddaughter because I see what happened is the prior screen captured it and didn't show up on this one. So, okay. So I want to go into Acts 21:22. We're going to do a little bit of dissecting and a lot of reading today. Again, that's completely intentional. I want to dive into it a little bit, and I want to start by reading just the first paragraph in Acts 21. I will be reading from the English Standard Version. As we pick up here, Paul is on his journey to Jerusalem. Okay. And it begins with, "And when he had departed from them," and them in this case is the elders at Ephesus, "and set sail, we came by a straight course to Kos, and the next day to Rhodes, and from there to Patara. And having found a ship crossing to Phoenicia, we went aboard and set sail. When we had come in sight of Cyprus, leaving it on the left, we sailed to Syria and landed at Tyre. For there the ship was to unload its cargo. And having sought out the disciples, we stayed there for 7 days. And through the Spirit, they were telling Paul not to go on to Jerusalem. When our days there were ended, we departed and went on our journey." Excuse me. "And they all, with wives and children, accompanied us until we were outside the city. And kneeling down on the beach, we prayed and said farewell to one another. Then we went on board the ship, and they returned home." Okay, so I want to kind of pause right there. There's actually a lot going on, and one of the things I'd like to kind of highlight, something that's really, you'll see a lot in the book of Acts, and Luke, often known as Luke the physician, is excuse me, he is a companion to Paul the apostle, and a lot of times when you follow his account in Acts, what you see is he switches to saying Paul did this and Paul did that to we. And the obvious conclusion is at this point, Paul is, or I should say, Luke is accompanying Paul on these journeys. Okay. Now, what I want to do a little bit, there's a lot of place names mentioned there. So, what I want to actually do is kind of unpack that a little bit and look at some of those locations. Okay. So, looking at these, they just left Ephesus. Okay. It's location of a prominent Gentile church there in Asia Minor. It's mentioned a lot in the New Testament. They sailed past. Let's see. They set a straight course to Kos, and I should let everybody know that I am certainly not an expert on New Testament place names, so I'm sure I'm going to butcher some of these. Kos, which is a Greek island located just off the Asia Minor coast. Let's see. I'll double check my reference here. Let's see. Apparently, they sailed to Rhodes. Now, Rhodes is a large island. It's considered a Greek island, even though it's off the Asia Minor coast. Rhodes is both the city and the name of the island. Okay. Then it speaks of traveling on to Patara, which is a major commercial city on the Asia Minor coast. And then they set sail across the Mediterranean, setting sail for Phoenicia. Which is a region along the Mediterranean coast. You hear a lot historically about the Phoenicians that originated in that area. They've traveled a lot, so when you talk about the Phoenicians in Phoenicia, you could be talking about different areas that they may have settled or may have been. But really, you're talking about an area that roughly corresponds to modern-day Lebanon. They talk about sailing past the island of Cyprus, which is a very large island in the eastern Mediterranean. To talk about heading to Syria. In the time of the first century, that refers to a province that spanned much of the Far East Mediterranean coast. They talk about heading on to Tyre, okay? And that again is a major city on the Syrian in the Syrian province on it's now in modern day Lebanon. They talk about let's see. Probably pronounced more like Ptolemy, which is a port city on the Phoenician coast. We'll get into these in the next chapter. They'll head on to move on to Caesarea, which is a major Roman city on the eastern Mediterranean coast. Of course, you recognize from the name, it's certainly Roman. It includes Caesar in the name. It's intended to honor Caesar. Of course, they talk later about heading to Judea, which of course is a land in Palestine, home of the Jewish people, and it's also considered a Roman province, the Roman province of Judea. And of course, they end up, the destination in this whole section we're reading is Jerusalem, which of course is the traditional capital of Judea. That's where the first century church was first founded, and a collection of prominent leaders still remain in that city. And so it's a very important city. In looking at Acts 21, and well, it's an important city throughout the New Testament, actually. And so the other things I want to show you is, now that I've talked about these place names, and again, there's a reason for this, not just, and I'll admit, I'm a geo nerd. I love this kind of stuff, so I'm drawn to it, but there's actually reasons that I'll lead up to at the end that I'm really bringing this about. So, as you noticed, and hopefully you can make out my cursor pretty well, they started off with Ephesus. They sailed. They went to here it's actually spelled COOS, Kos or Kos. Sailed to Kos, the island chain there. Continued on to the city of Rhodes on the island of Rhodes. They talked then about going to Patara. And now this artist shows an additional stop, apparently. But from there, there's these Passover laps. So I think that's probably why it looks a little confusing. But they return back, sail with Cyprus to their left. From there, they arrive in Tyre, which is in the province of Syria. Okay, this whole area around here could be considered, let's see, probably more up this way, the land of Phoenicia. Of course, they reference Tyre. And then Ptolemy, which they'll mention next, and then Caesarea. From there, eventually they make their way to Jerusalem. Okay. And again, aside just from being just a complete map nerd and location nerd and history nerd, which I hope you find this kind of interesting, we're going to talk a little bit to kind of help tie all these questions together when we look at this at the end. One of the things I'll just note again is, again, this is considered the province of Judea, from the first century Roman province. Okay, so we'll continue on from there. Just a little bit of background. When we had finished the voyage from Tyre, we arrived at Ptolemy, and we greeted the brothers and stayed with them for one day. On the next day, we departed and came to Caesarea. And we entered the house of Philip the Evangelist, who was one of the seven, and stayed with him. He had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. While we were staying for many days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. And coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands, and said, "Thus says the Holy Spirit, this is how the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." When we heard this, we and the people there urged him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And since he would not be persuaded, we ceased and said, "Let the will of the Lord be done." After these days, we got ready and went up to Jerusalem. And some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us, bringing us to the house of Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we should lodge. Okay. And now, Paul has arrived in Jerusalem. Okay. We'll continue on. When we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. After greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they had heard it, they glorified God, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to their customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses, so they may shave their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, that you yourself also live in observance of the law. But as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment, that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality. Then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them and went into the temple, giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. So an interesting note here, Paul talks about, in some of his other letters, he talks about how he'd been, like a Jew to the Jews, a Gentile to the Gentiles. He talks about how important it is to win over souls in any way possible. And so he's never said that Jews cannot continue their Jewish practices, their cultural practices. But what he is clearly adamant about is there is no longer any path to salvation that's available through Jewish customs. And so he's not saying that the Jews whose conscience dictates to them they continue their Jewish practices. He doesn't say that they need to stop or violate their conscience. But he does adamantly preach against is this idea that somehow you have to convert to the works of the law to find a path of salvation, because that just doesn't exist anymore. And he's adamant about that. So for anybody who might be a little confused by this, I think if you really look and understand Paul's writings on this topic, I think it's very consistent with what he says. But again, it's important, and John's really good about pointing this out, is you want to look at the broader context. You want to look at all the writings, and when you see is, this is very consistent with what he says. And so again, it's important to we look at that context, and then you say, I can see what Paul's doing here. He's, he doesn't want to be present a stumbling block to the Jews. And he's not saying that, for those people whose conscience would be seared if they just felt like, they couldn't just abandon their Jewish ways, their Jewish customs. But he's not in any way giving in to this idea that somehow there's salvation in the Old Testament law. Okay. So we'll continue on. This plot gets really interesting. Okay. So when the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law in this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." Okay, so yeah, these are the Jews that have been stirring up trouble continuously, and they've come to... Now they're in Jerusalem and they recognize him and say, "Oh, there's that troublemaker." Okay. Now, they've made a false accusation, and we'll see why. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Now, the name itself sounds distinctly Greek, right? Trophimus. I think it might be a little closer. And so they're just assuming that, he's bringing these Gentiles and defiling the temple. Okay, so an ungrounded accusation, but one that they believe. And it says, then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing, some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. For the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him." Okay, a little bit of background here. If you're a Roman soldier in a Roman province, you're away from Rome, your number one job above all else is to keep the peace. Keep it quiet, keep it orderly, Pax Romana, peace of Rome, everything needs to be orderly. We don't want any disturbances, and you'll see that come up again and again when you study the New Testament and they talk about how afraid they were of creating a commotion, okay? And you can only imagine what the Roman soldiers thought when they got assigned to Judea, when they were possibly sent off to that assignment, because they had a reputation for being real troublemakers. So the last thing they wanted is oh no, Jerusalem's in an uproar again, okay? So this gets even more interesting. This is really this dialogue here in this exchange gets very fascinating. So as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek?" Again, Greek being a very common language that was spoken at the time. He continues, "Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Again, doesn't know who Paul is, but he's speculating at, well, who's this troublemaker? Why are they so worked up? And Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew language, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus in Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, as of all of you are to this day. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women, as the high priest and the whole council of elders can bear me witness. For them I received letters to the brothers, and I journeyed toward Damascus to take those also who were there and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished." Okay. Now, interesting, Gamaliel is actually a really famous, well-known Jewish teacher. You can read about him today. Okay. "As I was on my way and drew near to Damascus, about noon a great light from heaven suddenly shone around me, and I fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting.' Now those who were with me saw the light, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Lord said to me, 'Rise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all that is appointed for you to do.' And since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing by me said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that very hour I received my sight and saw him. And he said, 'The God of our fathers appointed you to know his will, to see the righteous one, and to hear a voice from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to everyone of what you have seen and heard. And now why do you wait? Rise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name.' When I had returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.' And I said, 'Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by and approving and watching over the garments of those who killed him. And he said to me, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles."" Okay. Now, this account of him being present at the stoning of Stephen and his account of the Lord appearing to him on the road to Damascus, those accounts are actually described earlier in Acts. Okay. This is a repeat of those previous accounts. Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth." Now, keep in mind, what did he just say? "I will send you away to the Gentiles." And boy, are they offended by the idea of having anything to do with the Gentiles. So, again, up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. Now, keep in mind, it's not clear, does the tribune necessarily speak Hebrew? This exchange took place in Hebrew. It's possible he didn't actually even know what he said to the crowd. All he knows is the crowd all of a sudden is in a stir. And again, his job is to keep the peace. So he's got to figure out what's going on here, and he's got to put an end to it quickly. Okay? But when they had stretched him out for the whips, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, "What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman citizen." So the tribune came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" And he said, "Yes." The tribune answered, I bought this citizenship for a large sum." Paul said, "But I am a citizen by birth." So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately, and the tribune also was afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. Okay. Now, under Roman law, if you were a Roman citizen, you had a lot of rights that were not necessarily granted to those who were subjugated to the Romans. And so being a Roman citizen is very important under Roman law. And you'll see in earlier accounts that Paul has used his Roman citizenship at times to demand his rights. And ultimately, here in Jerusalem, he's going to appeal to Caesar, okay, which will ultimately send him to Rome. So this concept of being a Roman citizen is very, very important at this time, okay? And one last sentence to finish out the chapter. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. So the next chapter, you'll actually see the exchange. It's kind of interesting, too, if you want to continue the reading into that. It's Paul appeals to different parties within the leading council. He appeals to his fellow Pharisees, and because he recognizes that there's some common ground there in understanding of spiritual realms, that there being a resurrection, which is fundamental, of course, to our Christian belief. And so he appeals to that, but he actually you see an account that talks about the politics of his day. It's very grounded in, you know, what we know looking back from history. And so having done this and walked through this, I hope this was kind of enjoyable just to walk through, read God's word, not add much to it, really, just kind of let it speak for itself. But here's kind of the question, and the challenge I always have with a question like this is the folks that tend to watch these lessons are not the folks that need to hear the question, but yet it's an important question to consider. So, and here's the question. The account I just read, is this fact or is this fiction? And I fear in this modern day that a lot of people who may not be familiar with the Bible may be hearing accounts that Christians are delusional, they're kind of off on their own, they're out of sync with society these days, they're kind of in their own fantasy world. And so I can only imagine when you say, hey, let's go read the Bible, what they might picture the Bible even being like. But I think one of the things that struck me when I read this in our weekly reading is just how grounded in good historical account and just historical technique and historical accuracy these two chapters are. You get very distinct place names. You get a very orderly account. I think when historians look at the gospel writers across the board, but in particular Luke really stands out as a historian of the highest mark. And are there some things in here that are amazing? Yes. Oh yeah, certainly Paul's account of seeing the risen Lord is profound. But this is not something that you're not reading somebody's fantasy. You're not reading something that's just a legend that grew. And if you read legends, they're just so unrooted in anything that seems like reality. But when you read these chapters, it really strikes you. Acts in particular is just all this way. You're really struck with the level of detail, the attention given to historical facts, place names that you can go and research. And there's been times where people said, oh, Luke was wrong on this, and he proved out to be true. And so invite anybody who may have stumbled across this video and hasn't studied the Bible for themselves, read it for yourself. And are there some fantastic things in there? Yeah, there are. There's some amazing things in there. But at the same time, you'll be struck with the fact that its internal evidence is really compelling. There's a distinct attention to recording of facts, particularly when it comes to what the Lord's teaching. What was he really teaching? There's times that the there's an account of the apostles kind of just being not so bright, and there's embarrassing material that's kept there, not because there's a core group of people trying to make up a story, but because they're just trying to convey what actually happened. And so I hope these couple chapters kind of help open up the door for anybody who might have stumbled across this. I hope you could take more interest in reading the Bible and kind of just enjoying it. And ultimately, we gather here on a semi-regular basis, and so we can just let the Bible speak. And we hope that works for you as well. And hope you all have a blessed day and a blessed week. And stay safe and stay healthy.